A voice I almost recognized shouted hello back to me. Gloria! She came out of the jungle and I stepped toward her and stopped. She looked like a very accurate cartoon. Sexy short shorts and a halter top and bare feet. Bare feet? Walking in this jungle? Her clothes looked painted on and her hair was perfect, solid. Gloria? She repeated, hello. But her grinning mouth was full of long yellow spikes. Her muscles bunched to spring, and I fired twice. One bullet hit her knee, and the leap turned into a sprawl that covered half the distance. She snarled at me, a hair-raising sound like a sheet being torn, and staggered back into the jungle, changing as she went into a creature that looked like a large cat, crossed with an armadillo, armored shoulders and back. She left behind a spatter trail of bright blue blood. The xenobiologists were going to love this. Of course, there were Terran animals that used mimicry, but I think in a more timid way, trying not to be eaten. I don't think any of them tried to talk. Getting back inside the shuttle sounded like a really good idea. Not an easy one to accomplish, though, without a ladder. The bottom of the door was almost at eye level, and I had last done gymnastics about 30 years ago. But with the help of healthy fear, I did manage on the second try to swing my right leg up high enough to hook her heel around the corner of the door and scramble up gracelessly, pulling a big muscle on the inside of my thigh. I limped straight back to the survival gear bin and hauled out the big machine gun. 4 heavy magazines that held 50 rounds each were set up to fire bursts of 4, so I could tap the trigger 50 times, or just hose it around until the noise stopped. Reload and hose some more. Up in the temperate zone base, they had a noisemaker that made loud random bangs every minute or so, which kept the fauna away from the perimeter pretty well. Should I do that here? It might have the opposite effect, attracting curious flesh-eaters. I sat there listening to the jungle and trying to access the young and foolish man I had been 30 years ago. Man-eating creatures with big yellow teeth. Hey, just give me a gun. Now it's sort of, give me a transfer. We grow too soon old, my grandmother used to say, and too late smart. There was a noise at the edge of the clearing. I raised the weapon and realized that I didn't know what the drop was set for. Aim high or low? Well, I wasn't that good a shot anyhow. The woman who came out was not half naked and was not Gloria. She took one look at me and screamed. I lowered the rifle. Sorry! Waved at her. Get in the ship! There's a wounded animal out there! 3 of them followed her, sprinting across the sand. The others hobbling along as one five-legged limping beast. Gloria was trying to hop on one good leg, supported by 2 other women. Her leg gave out while I was watching. I slid down, keeping the rifle pointed at the jungle. What happened? Gloria didn't respond. Some goddamn thing bit her, another of the women said. Gloria was barely conscious, pale as snow except for the leg, angry red up past the knee, puffy with streaks of black. Is it gangrene? The woman whispered. She had a Texas accent, and her name patch said Laramie. I shook my head. I don't know. Gangrene was just a word to me, something that happened to people in old novels. This was probably something worse, something Venusian. In novels, the choice was always between amputation and death. I have a diagnostic suite, I said, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't designed to survive a crash landing. You weren't here, a tiny woman said. But here you are. Let's get her up there. It was a clumsy business, me hauling from above while the 2 taller women pushed from below. She cried out, then moaned and passed out, her eyes rolling up. Laramie was tall enough to lever herself aboard the way I had, and together we laid Gloria down gently on the cot that unfolded under the diagnostic machine. She was some sort of medical specialist, a caduceus patch on her blouse. She rapped on the two output screens and they stayed dark, ignoring her authority. Its on switch didn't do anything, even though it was properly set in the auxiliary power position. Well, the lights on the same circuit were dim. Maybe the machine required full power or nothing would happen. I got a near morphine pad out of the kit, but the nurse, Laramie, stopped me from tearing it open. "Better not," the short one said. "She's had more than a double dose already. Doesn't seem to do anything." They tried to undress her, but the swelling made it impossible. I found some shears in the toolbox that could just barely cut through her suit fabric, which was reinforced by some strong plastic thread. Taking turns, the three of us managed to cut a ragged line around the leg of her suit, just below the crotch, and then snipped down from there to the swelling. She woke enough to moan, shaking her head from side to side. I tried to say reassuring things, but she wasn't hearing them. Her jaws clenched against screaming, she squeezed my hand hard enough to make the knuckles pop. We snipped down far enough to relieve the local swelling, but that didn't seem to reduce the pain. "She's fighting something our bodies have no defense against," the medic said. "I don't know." Gloria cried out, back arched, then her body suddenly relaxed. Her eyes closed and she sagged into stillness. "Shit," the medic said quietly. She pressed two fingers under Gloria's chin. "She does have a pulse." She wrapped the machine again, harder. I got a multimeter out of the toolkit and checked a couple of connections. Exactly half of the power cell elements were dead. I unscrewed the top of the battery box and ducked away from the sharp smell of formic acid. "Here's the problem." I pointed to where the bottom three elements shared a wide crack, which oozed purple solute. "You can't fix them?" the small woman said. "Not even in a shop, no," I said. "On Earth, you just switch out the ruined elements, even on Mars." I picked up a dirty shirt and wiped the acid away from the crack with it and stared and thought, "Your own electrical system is out? Completely out?" "Well, I don't know about complete. The ship's dark," the medic said. "What about this part?" I tapped with a wrench. "The fuel cells." "Well, I guess it's pretty much junk," she said. "It's all crushed and..." "Julie's body's in there," Laramie said. "Stuck there. We couldn't get her out." "We didn't really try," the short one said. "No chance she survived." "Sounded grim enough." "No chance at all?" "Head crushed," Laramie said, her voice husky. "And a lot more." "Could you see the control console? I mean, is it possible the power cells are intact?" They looked at each other and shook their heads. "Couldn't see in," the medic said. "Didn't go too far in." "She was all over the place," the little one said. "We had to communicate her out and the canteens and didn't want to go back in if we could help it. We called you guys and they said you'd get here in an hour or so." In their dreams. But I checked my watch and was surprised to see that only a couple of hours had passed since I took off. I looked down in the direction they'd come from. "How far is the ship?" "Maybe 10 minutes down the trail," Laramie said. "It's a natural trail," she nodded. "Easy going." "You didn't cut it?" "Uh-uh. It was just there." That wasn't good. In the absence of people, it had to be a game trail. The planet had lots of herbivores, harmless enough in themselves, but the animals they were game for could be a problem. Probably one's last problem. I rummaged through the toolbox and selected the biggest screwdriver and some heavy metal shears, the kind that uses a heavy spring to magnify its force. A flashlight? Still one empty pocket in my fatigues. I wished for a grenade. "What? You're going back there?" the medic said. "Guess I have to." "You see an alternative?" "I'll come with you," Laramie said. "You don't have eyes in the back of your head." "I can't. Just give me the damn pistol and let's get going." "No place for chivalry here." I handed it to her and picked up the machine gun with an extra magazine. "You all stay inside here." As if anyone would go out for a stroll without a handy machine gun. I hopped to the ground and jacked around into the chamber. scanned the jungle line and gave Laramie a hand down. "Back the way we came?" she said. "Might as well. If we tried to beat a new way through the jungle, the noise might draw attention, though the rain was pounding down pretty hard." We were about a minute down the trail when we ran into our first fauna. It might have been a big green rock to a casual observer, but six stubby scaled legs appeared underneath it, and a large head craned out, bigger than a human head, and sporting a bright yellow beak and bulging sky-blue eyes. A black wattle on the sides of the beak and a crown of unruly black hair, gills flaring bright pink. It hissed and tipped back, reaching out with two front legs, arms, that sported glittering black talons. I fired once, and the bullet spanged off its shell, apparently to no effect. I aimed for the head, but by then it was gone, moving way too fast for a turtle-ish thing the size of a small car. It left behind a smell like burned chocolate. "Ever see one of these?" "Not so close," she said in a small voice. "Sometimes we'd see them watching from a distance, smell them, but we never caught one." "Probably a good thing. It's aquatic?" "We first saw them in the ocean."
"Wish they'd stay there. The sound of the shot, though, might have chased them away, back to the water. Or they were hiding, lying in wait."
We hustled down the path, swatting at bugs occasionally, but the biggest animals we saw were about cat-sized, or armadillo-sized. They all had shells. They didn't attack, but they didn't run away either. I smelled the wreck before I saw it. A wartime smell no one ever forgets. I swallowed back bile, and Laramie bent over and puked. She coughed a few times.
"God, we haven't been gone that long."
The scientist in me followed the same thread. How long does it take for 100-some pounds of meat to decompose that much? I knew from a unit in forensic medicine that it should take all day, or more, even in this heat. Even with a body that had been squashed? That would speed things up. "Probably some Venusian microorganism," she said hoarsely. That made me feel queasy. Whatever it was, I was breathing it. We went around a long curve and found the wreck. This ship was never going anywhere again. A big tree had crushed it between its reactor and fuel tanks, faint smell of hydrazine on top of the stench. The ramp up was twisted, and it creaked under our weight. We went up slowly, deliberately, not eager to get there. Julie had been beautiful. Now her face was gone. Every place skin had been exposed was a mass of red and orange cilia, wriggling. A body smelled of molasses and decay. Laramie edged around it without comment. The smell was different from my memory of corpses on Earth, when I'd been an unarmed medic in a short war. Burial detail. This was less pungent, perhaps sweeter, perhaps more like mold.
Most of mine have been dead for some while, though.
My feet didn't want to move. I couldn't take my eyes off the nightmare. I hadn't known her that well, but we had flirted in a joking way back at Farside a couple of years ago. The mouth I'd kissed goodbye was gray bone now, and two white teeth. "We don't have all day," Laramie said gently. There were no lights inside the wreck, but I had a small penlight. Fortunately, the pilot controls were old-style, almost identical to the ones I'd trained on. I unscrewed the access panel and held my breath when I touched the fuel cell terminals with the two multimeter probes. 23 volts. Plenty. "Think we're okay." I had to use the shears to free the fuel cell, doing maybe 10,000 credits damage. Send the bill to fucking Venus. It weighed less than 30 pounds, clumsy, rather than heavy. But I only had one free arm now. "Take this," I said, and traded her the rifle for the pistol. "You better lead." By the time we inched past, the corpse was totally covered with the colorful worms, writhing more slowly. Nothing human visible. You couldn't even see bones anymore. The smell was gone. "Same way?" she asked,
as we stepped carefully down the ramp.
Yeah.
What happened to the smell? Nothing left to generate decomposition gases, I suppose. She shook her head. In just a few minutes. Jesus. Fast work.
We had company before we reached the bottom of the ramp. A crawling horror about the size of a man was waiting patiently.
A chimera, with head and arms but no legs, just a long, tapering body, shiny with bright yellow scales. Three eyes that looked old and wise over a red mouth dripping saliva. A grin full of sharp teeth. We both fired and missed, and it squirmed away. My second shot hit its tail. It wailed like an oboe with a bad reed, and it rose up to stare back at us malevolently before it ducked under my third shot.
Get back in the ship? Laramie said in a quavering voice.
I don't think so. If we can't raise the ramp or close the door, we're going to just be dinner as soon as it gets dark. Have to get back to my ship. We were at the edge of the ramp when something moved in the brush in front of us.
Christ!
It also looked about man-size, but then raised itself up on a combination of arms and tentacles, dark blue and shiny and higher than my head.
I fired and missed, fired again and hit it square. It opened its mouth, bright red tongue and shark teeth, and said, "Oh! Oh!" in a loud bass growl. Laramie was pulling the trigger over and over, to no effect. "Arming lever," I said. "Cock it." "No," the beast said. "No, don't cock." Two spindly arms, like a Tyrannosaurus, raised up. My last bullet took an arm off at the elbow. It howled in pain. I said, "No, don't shoot me." A pink tentacle wormed out of the arm's stump. It turned dark blue, curling, then flexed, and became a new arm. "See?" Laramie lowered her weapon. "Are you talking to us?" "Yes, trying, talk. I left my finger on the trigger, but didn't pull it. I looked at the beast over the pistol sights. "You can talk?" "Yes, not good."
The new arm had completely regrown. The creature studied it from a couple of angles.
"Don't do that again. That hurts."
It picked up the severed limb and sniffed it, and then swallowed it in two horrible bites.
"Taste," it said. "A man should taste."
It shook its head violently.
"A man should share."
"No." It looked at its new hand.
"Pain. Peril. A man should share the passion and action of his time at peril of being."
It opens its jaws wide with a loud cracking sound, then sat back and cleared its throat.
"A man should share the passion and action of his time at peril of being judged not to have lived." Oliver Wendell Holmes, 1884, Old Style, May 30.
"How do you know that?" she asked.
Julie. "I know what Julie has in her brain," it nodded slowly. "Had in her brain at the time that she joined me." "Because you ate her?" I said. "Ate her brain? Jesus!" No, it shook its head violently, spraying tendrils of saliva. Because it's hard itself.
"Riddles," I said, and tightened my grip on the gun.
"Wait," Laramie said. "You mean because, like, causality? That's hard?" "Yes," the beast's gaze swiveled to her. "Causality is not simple. I am her. When Julie died here, she became part of here, part of Venus, and so part of me. She will always be." It looked back at me, huge blue eyes. "Everything, every worm, every microorganism that ever died on Venus is part of Venus forever. It's different from Earth and Mars, I think. I heard a step behind me and turned. It was Julie. My Julie. Naked, whole, unharmed. Next to her, Gloria. Also naked, leg completely healed. Dying is not the same here, darling, Julie said, and shrugged. Not so permanent. I fainted dead away. The science of it is still not clear, to put it mildly, if it even is science. The Venusian I tried to kill has sort of died dozens of times in the centuries of life it remembered. For a Venusian to actually die for keeps, it takes something catastrophic, like a fire. Otherwise it will go through a rejuvenating process like the grisly transformation we had seen starting with Julie's body. Food for worms doesn't mean the same thing as on Earth. There's a lot that doesn't mean the same thing anymore. Astronomy, biology, cosmology, just to start down the alphabet. If a planet can be sentient, what do you redefine? Planets or sentience? It has to be both. And everything. It's an existential headache, and not just existential. The main thing Julie suffered was a profound career change, from explorer-scientist to laboratory animal, or perhaps a new kind of explorer. As far as researchers have found, all she lost was a portion of long-term memory. She could still do calculus and higher math, but had to relearn the multiplication tables and long division for them to work. We spent many hours picking up where we had left off, on Farside a few years ago. At first, I was helping her to reclaim her memory. Then we started making new memories of our own. So now I'm living with a woman who is, I suppose, technically not human. That hasn't stopped us from making a couple of copies. So far, they seem to work all right.
Stephen Lay. In the tense story that follows, a man who lost almost everything on Venus returns to the planet that had nearly cost him his life, and to the woman who had urged him on to destruction, to give them both another shot at finishing the job. Stephen Lay is the author of the New Eden series, which consists of Slow Fall to Dawn, Dance of the Hag, and A Quiet of Stone. He's also the author of the Mictlan series, consisting of Dark Waters Embrace and Speaking Stones, and has contributed 6 novels to the Ray Bradbury Presents series, some with John L. Miller, including Dinosaur World, Dinosaur Planet, Dinosaur Warriors, and Dinosaur Conquest. His standalone novels include The Bones of God, The Crystal Memory, The Woods, and The Abraxas Marvel Circus. He has also contributed to the Wild Card series and the Isaac Asimov's Robot City series, and has written as S.L. Farrell and Matthew Farrell. His short stories have been collected in A Rain of Pebbles and A Tapestry of 12 Tales. His most recent novel is Assassin's Dawn, a book in the New Eden series. Lay lives with his family in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Bones of Air, Bones of Stone by Stephen Lay. Read for you by Gethin Anthony. Take a small rock, toss it into a rotating cylinder, and pour in abrasives. Tumble the mess for several days while the grit gnaws at the hard edges and scrubs the rounding surfaces. What eventually emerges from the harsh chrysalis of the tumbler is rock subdued and transformed, shimmering and polished like molten glass, all the hidden colours and veins revealed. Somewhere in my early teens, my parents gave me a rock polishing kit. I went pretty quickly through the provided assortment of pebbles, pleased with what came from my growling, slow cylinder, but bored with the tedious long hours needed for the result. Like most kids that age, I preferred instant gratification. I would almost certainly have set the polishing kit aside like every other hobby of the month I'd owned, except that my grandmother, Ivako, came up to my room one evening not long after. "Here, Tomio, she said, handing me a drab, ordinary piece of dark rock. Run this through your noisy machine for me. Sure, I said. We were all used to the brusque demands of the Norcone shuttle's matriarch, just as she was used to obedience. I tossed the rock up and down in my hand. It was nothing I'd have chosen, a chunk of undistinguished granite. Why don't you get some opal from the gardener, Obasan? I suggested, not wanting her to be disappointed with what I was certain would be mediocre results. It'd look a lot better. She sniffed, taking the rock back from me and holding it in her fingers. I remember that her fingers were thin and wrinkled already, with knuckles swollen and large with arthritis that would only worsen as the years went on. Obviously you don't know what this is, she told me. It's granite, I told her, and it's about as common as dirt. She shook her head at me. This is Akiko, my Obasan. I could feel my brow wrinkling. I don't understand, Obasan. So I see. Obasan Ivako sighed and sat on my bed, twirling the rock in the afternoon sun coming through the window. Akiko had a wonderful garden in our villa in Chincha Alta. I grew up there, and that's where I always came back to visit her. On my last visit, just before she died, I took this stone from the garden. Not an important stone, not any different from a thousand others there. Yet, every time I look at it, I can see Akiko again and that garden. As long as the rock lasts, so will that image in my mind. She had been speaking more to the sunlight and the rock than to me. Now she turned and fixed her gaze on me, as sharp as the flaked edges of the rock. How can this rock be less than beautiful with the truth and memories it holds? She didn't say anything else, just placed the pebble on the cover of the bed and left the room, knowing that I'd do what she'd asked. And of course I did. It took several days to give the rock the right sheen, to take all the edges from it. When I finally took it from the tumbler, a pointillistic swirl of colours rolled in the palm of my hand, and I found myself turning it over and over, marvelling at the complex play of hue and shade. Obasan Ivako, when I gave it to her, nearly smiled. Now it looks more like her than ever, she said. Now I can see the true beauty of her that was hidden in the stone. Ever since then, for many years, I would take common pebbles from places that were important to me at the time and try to uncover whatever gift they held. Many times the results were disappointing, an utter waste of time. But a few of them I've kept with me wherever I've gone. A pale pink crystal shot with fractures that comes from the garden of the Norcone estate on Cape Hinomisaki near Izumo. A piece of home that pulls Nippon and especially Shimane Prefecture up from its resting place in my mind. A thick needle of dark grey granite from the hills of New Hampshire, where I went to university. The subtle, rich satin of its surface never failing to conjure autumn on the east coast of North America. A nearly round ball packed with fine, crazed white lines from Tycho Crater on the moon. My first trip off-world. The quick panic of stepping outside, unprotected from vacuum except by my spacesuit. The euphoria of bounding in one-quarter gravity across dusty plains. A red-orange marble with streaks of rich brown. I plucked that from Olympus Mons on Mars during my ascent with Avario. I thought then that I'd met the one true love of my life with her. An ebony, glassy spheroid speckled with blue-black highlights. The beach at Blackstone Bay. That stone was also Avario. That stone was Venus. I'd not expected to be back on Venus ever again. I thought that all I would ever attain of Venus and Avario was that fragment of polished lava. The single precipitous main street of Port Blackstone was raucous and loud and more crowded than I remembered. There were even a few shrilialla on the streets too, something that when I was last here, a decade and a half ago, wasn't common. Back then, if you saw shrilialla, the sentient Phoenician race who lived under the waves of the Always Sea, the endless and shallow ocean that covers their world, it was either down at Undersea Port or if you were out on the Always Sea. I could smell their cinnamon-laden exhalations as I passed them, sucking in seawater from the bubblers strapped between the double line of fins down their backs. The buildings I passed on the way, clinging like limpets to the steep side of the volcanic island that was the single landmass on Venus, seemed weary and exhausted. The fresh paint that had been smeared on them seemed like the too thick makeup on an ancient whore, enhancing rather than hiding age. The smell was the same, though. The winds that smeared the low ranks of the clouds over Port Blackstone smelled of the always sea, an odour of sulphurous brine, a stench of rotting vegetation, the cinnamon of the Shrielyala. The air was as thick as I remembered its being, heavily oxygenated and laden with moisture. There was no sun. There was never a sun during Venus's day, only the smeared, unfocused light that the clouds allowed through. And the rain. If the Eskimos have 100 words for snow, the humans who live on Venus have nearly as many words for the types of rain that the eternal clouds spew down on them. It was raining now, as it usually did, what the locals called a sheeta, a needle-like wind-driven spray that was part rain and part foam ripped from the ocean waves. The sheeta hissed and fumed against my rain shield as it pummeled the buildings on either side of me. Lightning shimmered blue-white through the clouds overhead, sending brief racing shadows across the street. The thunder followed a half-second later, crackling and loud enough to rattle the windows in the nearest buildings. I walked down Blackstone's lone, rain-slick street from the flat plateau where the supply shuttles landed on the shoulder of the volcano toward the port proper, my luggage rolling along behind me on its autocart. At the far end of the street, amongst the piers and jetties and the internal wave spray, the street finally plunged under the long racing swells, undersea port where the human world met that of the Shrielyala. Maybe it was the relentless and grim dimness of the day. Maybe it was my expectations. Maybe it was the oppressive heat. Have I mentioned the heat yet? But Venus and Blackstone seemed less than enthusiastic in welcoming me back from Earth after over a decade. A group of youths, dressed in thin labourers' clothing, ran by me in the rain, shouting half-heard words in their thick Venusian accents that might have been curses. Shopkeepers leaned in the doorways of their businesses, staring at me like the intruder I was. I knew why they stared. It's not often that you see a person with field prostheses, especially not in an age where limbs can usually, such a comforting word unless it doesn't apply to you, be regrown. The emptiness between my hips and shoes were twin-shaped fields, the controls implanted along my spine. The shoes, the far end of the field, moved as if attached to bone, sinew and flesh, which showed my years of practice. In the correct light, you can see the heat waver of the fields. An imaginative person can sense the flexings and almost glimpse the transparent legs. Almost. I would wear long trousers and have it appear that my body is whole, albeit somewhat stiff, but why play that charade? Obasanavaka always scolded us for telling unvoiced lies, for pretending to be something we weren't. Besides, no one wears much clothing on Venus. It's too damned hot and too damned wet for that. So instead, I wore shorts which just covered the stumps of my thighs, which means that I looked like the torso of a dismembered body floating ghost-like a meter above the ground. I wondered how many of those here would think back 15 years and remember my face from the newscasts of the time. Probably none of them looked at my face at all. 15 years ago, I'd left my legs behind on Venus. I'd left behind a lot more as well. I ran fingertips over the cool, smooth surface of the stones in my pocket, and when I found a familiar shape, I pulled it out. The stone, polished and about as big as the tip of my little finger, was satin black and glassy, flecked with a blue that was almost black itself. I turned it in my fingers, looking at all the familiar swirls of its polished surface, then shoved it back in my pocket. My last stop had been the Blackstone Library and the data terminals there. Avariel was here, somewhere. When the Green Council announced that Blackstone would be reopened to off-world traffic, I'd known she would come here. I'd been afraid she would. Now I'd seen the permits from the Green Council, and I knew what she was planning to do. And that scared me. The night was strained with some invisible tension, and those outside glanced up at the eternal clouds of the planet as if they might see some doom about to descend on them. I'd probably find my own, I was certain, before too much longer. I left the streets gladly. As I entered the hostel's lobby, the owner opened one eye and blinked at me from behind the desk. From the shifting blur of colour in his left eye and a haze of tinny sound around him, I knew he was watching something on his implant. He'd also gone native. Those who had decided to make Venus their permanent home often had surgical modification, and I could see the healing tracks of gill covers along the proprietor's neck. He snarled something in my direction. What was that? I asked.
Oh, yeah. Spread those legs, you bitch.
Not having legs, I assumed that wasn't directed to me and waited as he grumbled to his feet. His grimy fingers, new webbing set between them, scrabbled on the grimier plastic of the registration desk.
You need a room,
he mumbled, only slightly louder this time. He reached below the counter, then slapped down a registration pad. His hand stayed on it, fingers splayed so that the speckled webbing was prominent.
Usually we're closed by now, he stated. I stayed up past my usual time because I knew there was a passenger on the shuttle.
His right eye stared. Vague shapes moved in his left. A chorus of insects moaned around him.
Nice of you to do that, I ventured. I'm missing the best part of my favourite show now.
A forefinger tapped the pad. I fumbled in my pocket, the one without stones, and fished out the coins I found there. I placed them alongside the pad. His hand spider-crawled over to the money, and I put my hand on the pad. It beeped and chirped.
Room's just down the hall, the hostel owner said.
I nodded to the owner. His duty accomplished and tip secured, he was already lost in his entertainment. He didn't even notice my lack of legs. His eyes were closed, his lips moved with the verse of some unheard song. I went down the hall to my room. I stayed long enough to unpack a few things, then hobbled out of the hostel toward the lone Blackstone Tavern, fumbling with anxious fingers at the 5 or 6 polished stones in my pocket. 15 years ago, the establishment had been called By the Sea, and Avariel and I had eaten and gotten drunk there a few times before we left the port. The sign outside the establishment proclaimed that it was now Venus Genetrics, Mother Venus. I doubted that anyone here either knew or cared. I was just glad to leave the wet, steep streets and the suspicious stairs for the bar.
Fuck! Look at that!
Someone said as I entered, in an inebriated stage whisper. Half the patrons of the tavern glanced around at me with that, and in the blur of faces, I saw her. In an alcove to the back, she sat in the dim light. Seeing Avariel reminded me of too many things. I wanted to hide. I wanted to run. Running is one thing I'm no longer capable of. Walking's the best I can manage. Instead, I smiled, rattled the stones in my pocket, and walked toward their alcove. Next to her was a Shrielyala, the tubes of a bubbler wrapped around its purple and green neck over the gill slits, its long web fingers lifted as if it were in mid-speech with Avariel, though its mouth was closed and it, too, was looking my way. Its huge eyes blinked once, the transparent underlid sliding sideways, the translucent overlid sliding up from their pouch under the eyes. The Shrielyala had the slash of an overseer tattooed on the lilac scales of the crown of its head. Beneath it was the emerald dot that said that it was a member of the council. There was another mark, too. A short, yellow-white bar bulging slightly at either end. This Shrielyala possessed bones of air, a mutation that caused some Shrielyala to have lightweight, air-pocketed bones, which meant it could never sink into the great darkness to rest with its own kind, the normal Shrielyala, with what they called bones of stone. Instead, this Shrielyala would be burned here on the island when it died, in the caldera at the summit of Blackstone, the place the Shrielyala call the pit. Avariel watched my approach with a careful, almost smile on her face. The Venusian watched as well, but I knew that attempting to read any human emotion into that face would be a mistake. Avariel, I said when I reached their table.
I thought I might find you here. She looked older. Somehow I hadn't expected that. There were severe lines around her eyes and at the corners of her mouth that hadn't been there before, and creases around her neck. Grey had settled in the dark brown hair of her temples. Her arms were covered with white patches of scars, some of them new. But she was still muscular and fit, still the athlete, ready to conquer any physical task to which she set herself. Her smile flickered, settled. Tomio, she answered flatly. The Shrieliala's huge eyes swiveled in their sockets as it looked from her to me. Bubbles thrashed their way through the clear plastic pipes connecting its gill bubbler to the tank on its back. I have to admit that I didn't expect to see you here. Really? I answered, returning her meaningless smile. After the Green Council's decision, I thought you'd expect me to come here, if only because I knew you'd be the first one here. Tomio, a sigh. Her fingertips tapped an aimless rhythm on the tabletop near her ale. There's no going back to what we were. I'm sorry. You really shouldn't have come here. I raised my hand. Uh-huh, I said. Our relationship isn't at issue. You know, despite everything, I would have come if you'd asked, if you'd stayed in touch after... I gestured at the empty space below the stumps of my legs and the floor. Don't lay that guilt at my door, Tomio, she said. I won't accept it. The Shrieliala seemed to hiss, spraying a fine mist of water from its mouth. It adjusted the bubbler. The salty droplets pooled on the varnish of the table. We all looked at it. The humans know one another. Her humans know one another. It had been a long time since I'd heard the Shrieliala accent. I had to replay the comment in my head before I understood what it had said, by which time Avariel had already answered. Tomio was here with me the last time, Hasalalo, she said. We went down into the great darkness together. The Shrieliala nodded. The last time. The water going from green to blue to black. I'd thought it would be easy. I thought we'd just swim down and down until we reached the bottom. Avariel's comment was all that was needed. Hasalalo seemed to know immediately what she referred to, even if for the short-lived Shrieliala the events of 15 Earth years ago were a generation removed. Hasalalo, who looked to be in his prime years, probably hadn't been alive then, or was just a newly sprouted bud. Will it? Hasalalo stumbled over the pronoun and spat water again. I mean, he be going with you this time? No, Avariel answered. Her gaze was on me, and the smile had seemingly vanished. He won't. In fact, he shouldn't be here now. She started to get up. I reached out and found her arm. Avariel, I'm sorry, really, please don't go. In the dim light, her eyes were bright with reflections. The great darkness took my legs, I said. I think that's all the motivation I need. Avariel, you knew you were coming back as soon as the Green Council would allow it, but you weren't sure that I would. I wasn't the one who left the relationship as soon as possible after I was hurt. I saw a trail of moisture on her face and I suddenly hated myself. I'm sorry, I said. That was unfair. No, she answered very softly. I don't think that was unfair at all. Then we could still do this together. Optimism rose like a bird. No, and plummeted, stricken back to the floor. But I understand why you had to ask. Neither of us said anything for long seconds after that. Avariel sighed and reached down below her chair, pulling up a backpack. She put the straps around her shoulders and cinched the left side tightly, muscles knotting along her jaw. Getting to the bottom of the great darkness was the only time I failed at something I tried, she answered finally. That's why I'm here. Avariel adjusted the other strap and got to her feet, hefting the pack. People sometimes need something so badly that they'd sacrifice nearly anything to attain it, she said. I wouldn't want it to be any other way. Not for me. I thought it was you, I wanted to tell her. I thought it was you that I needed like that. Now, I just don't know, and I thought if I saw you again, I might find out. I understand, was all I said. I hope you do, she said, slinging the pack over her shoulder, then her voice and her face softened. I never wanted to hurt you, Tomio. I hope you can believe that, at least. I'm sorry I wasn't the type of person who could share her life with you, and maybe that was more my fault than yours. I shrugged back at her. If you had been that person, I probably wouldn't have wanted you so much, I told her. She lifted her chin at that, then her gaze slid over to Hasalalo. Make the arrangements, Hasalalo, she told the Venusian. I'll come to you tomorrow with the final part of the fee, and we'll do this. Yes, Avario. Yes. With a hiss and a lisp, the liquid affirmation came wafting over the table laden with the odor of cinnamon. Avario nodded once before turning and leaving. After Avario had gone, I looked at Hasalalo. It looked at me. So, you were the other human who descended with her, it said, halfway between question and statement. You were the reason she never reached the bottom of the great darkness and saw the ancestor bones or the lights in water. Yeah, I told it. It was my fault. The words tasted far more bitter than I intended, and I tried to temper them with a smile that I wasn't sure the Shrieliala would understand. It only nodded. I'll never see the great darkness or the lights in water either, it said, and it touched the pale bar tattooed on its head. Its gill bubbler hissed. It sounded like a sigh. I didn't quite know what to say to that. I knew from my time on Venus that when a Shrieliala dies anywhere on this world, no matter how far away the colony might be, its body is carried out to the great darkness, a deep canyon just off the shore of Blackstone Mountain, with great ceremony by a group of Shrieliala dedicated to that task. Priests might be the best term, but given that the Shrieliala don't have organized religions in the sense that we think of them, it's also a very wrong term. Hell, I wasn't entirely certain how the Shrieliala even reproduced, though I'm certain some of the scientists stationed here could have told me. The body is released over the great darkness with a prayer. Or maybe it's just a ritual statement, and Shrieliala bodies, with bones of stone being heavier than water, the dead one drifts steadily down through the blackness of the waters into the depths toward, well, toward whatever's at the bottom, which no human has ever seen. We know what the Great Darkness is. Once a long vertical hollow in the volcanic rock, perhaps a lava tube reaching up from the plumes far, far below. But the thin roof of the vertical cavern collapsed under the corrosion and weight of the water above it, leaving the great darkness. Beyond that, the Shrieliala are close-mouthed about it, and they refuse to allow any of our cameras or robotic instruments to accompany any of the bodies on its journey. As sentient beings, we have to respect that, and we have. To them, it's a sacred place and not to be violated. But they did once allow Avario and myself to undertake the journey on our own. And we failed. Or rather, I failed, and therefore Avario also failed. I saw a flash, or thought I did, and something like an undersea wave pummeled me and I hit the side of the canyon. Rocks began to fall, and I shouted for Avario, but then I felt the crushing pain, and when I awoke again, I was back in Blackstone in the hospital. Or at least half of me was. I must have spent too long in reverie because Hasalalo's bubbler hissed again as it spoke. You and Avario were lovers? That's not a relationship we can understand. Neither can we most of the time, I told it. Hasalalo burbled more to itself, its large eyes blinking and its hand spreading so that I could see the translucent, speckled webbing between the long fingers. The skin glistened with the gel the Shrieliala use to retain moisture when they're on land. Why did you want to see the great darkness and the lights in water? It asked. Before? I didn't, particularly. Hasalalo blinked. It seemed to be thinking through the English. How? It stopped, breathed. Then why? It asked, Avariel wanted it. And I wanted Avariel. Hasilalo shivered. I seem to remember that was the Venusian equivalent of a human shrug.
That is the explanation?
I grinned at the Shrieliala. It's all I got, I told it. Maybe my grandmother could explain it better for you, if you ever meet her. The memories flooded back with that. The affair was more or less in honour of Avariel. I say more or less, because back then, Obasan of Arco arranged gatherings every month or so, whether there was an excuse or not. Avariel had just completed the ascent of the previously unconquered eastern cliffs of Olympus Mons on Mars, an expedition sponsored by the family company, Norcone Shuttles. Our PR department was already churning out ads trumpeting our involvement. I'd been on the support team, my own climb confined to a leisurely ascent of the lower lava flows. I'd shivered a lot in the shelter of Base 1 while Avariel and her support team of genuine climbers went on. They'd go to Base 2 and Avariel would finish the climb solo, as she always did. She and I were lovers already. I'd wondered about that at first, suspicious that the primary reason she'd come to my bed was because I'd been the one who had talked Obasan of Arco into parting with the grant for the climb. Still, we were good lovers, comfortable with each other. We were friends. I was well on the way to considering making the relationship more permanent, in love with the idea of being in love. Mobile fabrics were the fashion that season. Most of the people wearing them shouldn't have been, though I thought Avariel looked fine. Her blouse, restless, crawled slowly over her shoulders. I'd be talking to her, but my gaze would be snagged by her neckline slipping suggestively lower. That was a good time for voyeurs. The evening was turning cool, and I was getting tired of smiling at people I really didn't like that well. I found Avariel in the garden and detached her from the gaggle of admirers around her. The hover lamps had just turned themselves on, flickering like huge fireflies around the lawn while Mount Fuji turned golden on the horizon. Touching her arm, I inclined my head to the blaze of lights that was the house. Let's go inside. I have a few people you should meet. She nodded and made polite noises to her crowd, but when we were away from them, she sighed. Thanks. I've been trying to lose them for the last half an hour. I have to say that sometimes I miss being all alone up on Olympus Mons. Shame on you, Tomioff, for leaving me to those wolves. Part of the bane of being the host. The party was noisier and brighter and more crowded inside. Lots of glitter, meaningless laughter and full glasses. As we stood watching in the doorway, Obasan of Arco waved to us from where the caterers were setting the buffet. Tomio, she called loudly, you've been hiding the guest of honour from me all evening. I refuse to be neglected any longer. Bring her here. An imperious gesture accompanied the command. Those nearby tittered and smiled before turning back to their drinks. I grinned. Avariel, glancing from me to my grandmother, smiled uncertainly in my direction. Obasan could be intimidating to those who didn't know her. I could feel Avariel's fingers digging into the skin of my arm. Obasan of Arco was a small, thin woman, half Japanese and half Northern European, with short white hair and a well-wrinkled face. She exuded energy and purpose, carrying a habitual frown on her lips. To those she wanted to leave with the impression, she was hard, brittle ice. Most of the family knew better. Don't worry, I whispered to Avariel. She's really a lamb. Avariel's glance told me she didn't believe me. We made our way over to my grandmother, who stood waiting, one foot tapping the carpet. Countefia no regentia no cone, Avariel said, using Obasan's full title from the Asian Lien Mong, and bowing as proper etiquette required. Obasan looked Avariel up and down as if she were a piece of furniture. Then she glanced at me. She spoke in Mandarin, not Japanese or English. I'm surprised at you, Tomio. She's not your type. When you talked about this Olympus Mons business, I expected to see one of the usual pieces of pretty fluff you dragged down here. I'm not fluff, Countefia. That from Avariel, who had straightened and now looked more irritated than flustered. I can talk, and I even understand what people say about me, she answered in heavily accented Mandarin. That snapped Obasan's head around.
She stared at Avariel with lion-trapped eyes, then nodded.
Good. See that you manage to stay unfluffy. It's too damn easy to become comfortable. By the way, I assume you realize that your outfit doesn't flatter you at all. Stay away from fashions unless they enhance your image. I'd use simpler and more classic clothing with that body.
Avariel blinked.
Count Effia, she began, but Obasan cut her off with a wave of a thin hand. Call me Ivarko. Anybody who can make Tomio behave sensibly deserves the courtesy of familiarity. He's been paying more attention to the business lately, if only because I told him that he needed to pay back the sponsorship of your climb.
I want to thank you for that. It was a waste of money.
Another blink.
I'm sorry you feel that way.
Let me finish, child. It was a waste of money unless it's finally taught Tomio what can be accomplished when you want something badly enough. He's had everything too easily, and it's ruined him. I told his parents it would.
Avariel glanced back at me and saw that I was still grinning. She managed to look puzzled and faltered into a defense.
Tomio was a great help to me. Without him...
Bah!
With another wave of her hand.
Without him, you'd still have managed the climb, one way or another. You'd have found some other funding. Don't delude yourself on that. Having Norcone's backing was convenient, but the loss of it wouldn't have stopped you.
Then she gave her the briefest of smiles. It smoothed her face.
God's child. If you don't allow us elders our bluntness, how am I ever going to convince the idiots around here that I'm not someone they can walk over?
I don't think that's anything you need to worry about.
Oh, you'd be wrong. You'll need to do the same. Let me tell you another truth. What you do is ultimately meaningless. You climb a thing or attempt things so that you'll be the first one to accomplish it, so you'll get to engrave your name in the record books. But that's emptiness. You also climbed Rhea Silvia's central peak on Vesta 4 years ago, and 2 years ago were the first person to take a submersible down through Europa's ice pack to the liquid ocean below. But beyond that, do you know either Europa or Vesta? You climbed Olympus Mons, yes, but do you know Mars as a result? No. You made your climb and you left. You've no relationship with the places you've gone. Just like you have no real relationship with my Tomio.
It was my turn to protest at that. Obasan, I began, but she lifted her hand toward me without taking her gaze from Avariel.
I can tell that you'd be pretty if you wanted to make the effort, Obasan said to her. You're neither beautiful nor stunning, mind you, and I'm sorry if that bothers you, but you really don't want false flattery. Still, you'd be easily as attractive as most of the people here tonight if you'd taken the hours they did to get ready. Yet you didn't bother. Very little cosmetics, no gloss, no fakery except that mistake of a blouse, which you probably chose because you thought it was expected. All that's good. You look like someone out of the ordinary the way you are, while if you tried for looks, you'd just be one within the multitude. Well, I'm like that also. I act just differently enough that no one makes the mistake of treating me like all the people I'd resemble otherwise. It's a good trick. Keep it. Teach it to Tomio, too, while you're about it. He'll try to learn, if only because he's in love with you.
Obasan! I tried again, and this time I got a glance.
Oh, she already knows it, Tomio. She's too smart not to have seen it, and you're just damned lucky that she's not taken more advantage of your vulnerability. You should try to keep her if you can, but it'll take some doing. I don't know if either of you are up to the task. You're another little cliff she needed to scale, and though I love you, Tomio, you're still trying to figure out what it is you want in life.
Obasan Ivarko gave a little start, then her mouth twisting back into a frown.
I've forgotten to check with the caterer about the wine. He'll try putting it on ice again, and it should be served chilled, not cold. I want to talk to you later, Avariel.
You can tell me how Norcone's going to get its money's worth from this Venus expedition. Termio, play host while I convince the caterer that it's his decision to serve food the proper way. With that, she left us, moving away with a quick, unstoppable stride, already calling out loudly for the head caterer. Avariel laughed once, more in relief than anything else.
Good God, you might have warned me, she said, staring at Obasan's wake.
Hey, she likes you.
What does she do when she hates someone? I saw her face scrunch into a scowl. She doesn't know me as well as she thinks she does.
You'd be surprised at what she probably knows.
Uh-huh. Avariel glanced toward the bar and the restless tide of people around it. I couldn't tell if she believed me or not.
After that, I think I need a drink, she said.
I waved the bartender over to our table as thunder from outside rattled the windows and Hasalalo burbled in its gill bubbler. What do you have that passes for scotch? I asked her. She was another adapted human native. Even though her skin was brown, there was still a sense of pallor to her that only came with the eternal lack of sunlight here. Her eyes had been surgically altered, the iris and pupil widened, and a protective underlid added, much like that of the Shrilyala. There was webbing between her long extended fingers also, and the twin lines of gills were on her neck, with long scarlet fronds that said they'd been there a long time.
If you want genuine, it's expensive, she told me. If you'll take the local variety, it's cheap enough.
Expensive, I told her. I've had the local. She sniffed and glanced at Hasalalo.
Hasalalo? She asked,
which told me that she knew it fairly well. Hasalalo didn't reply immediately, and I prodded its arm.
Nothing,
I asked the Shrilyala.
I'm buying,
or rather my pension fund is buying. Hasalalo shook its head, and the bartender left.
You sure?
I asked it. I know you Shrilyala don't care for our particular poisons, but I knew a few of you who could slam back sugar water like crazy. It ignored what I said entirely. Staring at me, it said,
You didn't care if you saw the lights in water or the bones at the bottom of the great darkness? That's what I want more than anything. That's why I pushed the Green Council to let Avariel come back. She said she would tell me what she saw in the great darkness, what my body will never experience with bones of air.
Bones of air, I mused. That's all I have now. I meant it as a joke. Hasalalo's hissing was louder this time, more emphatic, and its voice had a timbre I rarely heard in Shrilyala before.
I thought you would understand, it said, though I wasn't sure if that was agreement, sarcasm, or denial. Have you seen the pit where those of us with bones of air go?
I hadn't, though sitting with Hasalalo I wondered why. I knew about the pit, the cauldron at the top of Blackstone Mountain, but Avariel had only glanced at the Blackstone's paltry heights, no challenge to someone with her athletic ability, and shrugged. She'd had no interest in a walk to the heights, only in her descent to where no human had gone before, so therefore I had expressed no interest either. But that seemed too much to explain to Hasalalo, so I only shook my head. It burbled some more, and, pushing away its chair, rose to its feet. Twin-scaled, long flippers with webbing extending down between the legs past the knobs of knees, far more suited to water than to land. On the land, Shrilyala waddled rather than walked.
Come,
it said, and gestured. I rose from my own seat. It's a long walk to the pit, I told it, and on the steep side. I gestured at the space where my legs should have been. Do you think... It stared at me with huge eyes that blinked wetly. From the tank on its back, a nozzle hissed and sprayed thick, gelid water over the Shrilyala.
Come,
it said again. The command in its voice reminded me of the way Obasan Avarko spoke. I came, calling to the bartender that I'd be back for that scotch later. She grimaced, clearly annoyed, though whether it was with me or Hasalalo or both of us, I couldn't tell. She shook her head as we left. I shouldn't have worried about the walk.
As we left the bar, an open-top scooter hurried quickly over through the rain from somewhere farther down the street, driven by another Shrieliala, illuminated by flashes of lightning and accompanied by thunder. Hasalalo entered the small cab behind the driver, then gestured to me.
"Come," it said again.
As I slid into the seat alongside it, Hasalalo leaned forward and said something to the driver in English. The Shrieliala never spoke anything but English while on land. The driver nodded. The scooter whined and complained as it made its way away from the harbour. We moved back up Blackstone Single Road toward the plateau on which the port sat, and beyond it, now along an unpaved potholed trail toward the caldera that sat near Blackstone Summit. The hot spot in the crust that had created both Blackstone and the Great Darkness had moved on millennia ago and was undoubtedly building up a new island somewhere to the northwest. Once, this place would have been a steaming, hissing hell where the eternal rain hammered at sputtering lava flows. No more. The volcano of Blackstone was long dormant and cold. The driver stopped near the rim of the crumbling crater, and we got out into a driving rain with lightning crackling around us. I'd thumbed on my rain shield as soon as we'd left the bar. Hasalalo seemed to relish the wetness. Here, on the highest mountain that Venus had to offer, modest as it was, I could look out at the unbroken sweep of the Always Sea, at least to what the storm allowed me to see. I thought that out past Blackstone Bay, where the long ocean swell started, I could glimpse a darker green-blue against the lighter grey-green, the Great Darkness. I could smell the caldera long before I could see it. We made our way slowly over the broken, eroded volcanic rock to where we could look down, and I wished that the rain shield could keep out odours as well as rain. The caldera stank of rotting flesh. Shrieliala bodies in various stages of decomposition were scattered down the sides of the caldera in front of us, some of them half-draped over the slope just in front of us, as if they'd been tossed aside like so much unwanted trash. The floor of the crater was littered with their bones, flashing white in the erratic lightning flashes. Wrigglers, the blue-green maggot-like worms that were one of Venus's few land creatures, fed on the decaying matter. I gagged at the smell of rotting flesh and had to fight to keep my last meal in my stomach. Hasalalo was staring down with me, though I couldn't read the expression on its face to see if it matched the horror on mine. I looked more closely at the closest skeletons to us. Nested in the bones, I saw small clusters of rounded pebbles, rocks unlike any of the volcanic variety on Blackstone. Little groups of them were plentiful, almost as plentiful as the bones. I crouched down to look more closely. The stones were smooth on their ridges, though the rest of the rock was rough, as if they'd already been in a tumbler for a few hours. I glanced at Hasalalo and pointed to the nearest pile. Four or five of the stones caged under the curve of a Shrieliala's ribs. "May I?" I asked Hasalalo, who gave me an almost perfect human shrug. I hoped it meant the same thing, and reached down for one of the stones, carefully trying to avoid touching the bones that enclosed it. I managed to fish one out between two fingers and stood up, looking at it closely. In my hand, rain no longer varnished its surface. It dried quickly, almost as if the stone was absorbing the water. The stone was reddish, with light grey veins marbling it. The higher surfaces were almost polished, the lower ones still had lots of surface irregularities. I turned it in my fingers, looking at the black, glassy highlights, and wondering how it would look after I ran it through my tumbler. Blackstone Mountain. The Pit. Venus. "Can I keep this?" I asked Hasalalo. Its bubbler hissed. Hasalalo was watching me. Its underlid slid over its eyes and remained there as the rain started to pelt down harder. No longer a sheeter, but now what the locals called a pounder.
"Why?"
it asked. I reached into my pocket with my free hand and pulled out my little collection of polished rocks, displaying them to Hasalalo in my palm. "It's amazing what a rock looks like when you polish it like this. They become little jewels, the essence of the stone. Or maybe it's the truth inside the stone. It's something I do everywhere I go. See, this one, it's a rock I took from the beach the last time I was here.
blue-black glass, so finely polished that you could see the darker imperfections floating inside like planets nested in a dark nebula. Hasalalo leaned over my hand and stretched out a web-snaggled finger to touch it.
This is one of the black stones?
I nodded. Pretty, isn't it? I'd like to do the same with the stone from the pit, just to see how it comes out, to see what beauty it's hiding.
Do you know what you hold?
I shook my head. A hiss from the bubbler.
Tss, you know what happens to those of bones of stone when they die?
Yes. You release the bodies over the great darkness. There's something about reincarnation for a few and, well, your gods, the lights in water are down there and, my voice trailed off. The truth was that while I knew the Shri Liala had a complex mythology that revolved around the great darkness, all that Havariel had cared about was that no human had ever been all the way to the bottom of the great darkness and that she'd be the first. Therefore, that was all I cared about too. Just as I hadn't bothered to learn how the Shri Liala reproduced, I'd also ignored their beliefs. I figured the way they dealt with death was like our own tales of death and afterlife. Ancient myth and fantasy was none of it real.
Those with bones of stone fall into the great darkness, Hasalalo continued.
If it was annoyed at my bumbling narrative of their beliefs, I couldn't tell.
The lights in water feed on their flesh, leaving behind their bones, and among their bones are also their stomach stones. Sometimes the lights in water find a particularly beautiful stomach stone, and they take that stomach stone back up out of the great darkness and place the stone where a bud mother can find it. And when the bud mother swallows it, it sprouts a new Shri Liala, so that each Shri Liala may come back to life again. That's the possibility that awaits most Shri Liala in the great darkness. But not those of bones of air. I've talked to the eldest of us, and they say that the pit has always been the same. The lights in water can't come here, so the stomach stones left here never leave, and those who rot here are never reborn.
Hasalalo gestured to encompass Blackstone Mountain.
All this came to be because those of bones of air went into the great darkness by tying rocks around their bodies against all warnings, and the lights and water of the always sea grew angry and vomited up the bones of air in a fury of glowing rocks until the sea bottom rose above the always sea as a sign to never do that again. Since then, all of us with bones of air have been placed here and are forbidden the great darkness. I know Havariel believes this is just superstition, and so you probably think the same. The lights in water, their choosing of the stomach stones, everything about the great darkness is only myth. Maybe it is. Maybe there's no difference between what happens to those with bones of air and bones of stone. This is why I worked with the Green Council to allow Havariel to come back. She said she would tell me what she finds at the bottom of the great darkness. If she does, I will know. We will all know.
That was by far the longest speech I had ever heard a Shri Liala make. Through most of it, I was staring at the stone I was holding, a stomach stone, a gastrolith I knew now. Part of me wanted to drop it. This had been in the gizzard of one of the dead Shri Liala, which explained how it had been partially polished, grinding the sea plants that the Shri Liala ate.
Take the stone and find the truth inside it, Hasalalo told me as I hesitated. I wish to see it afterward.
I rubbed the stone between my fingers, thinking I could almost feel slime coating it, as if it had just been vomited up. I shivered, but I closed my fingers around it as Hasalalo stared at me. All right, I told it. I'll get it started tonight. It'll take a week or more, though. It takes a lot of time to get to the truth, as you put it. Hasalalo seemed to sniff.
If that is so, then why does Avariel never stay anywhere very long? Why do you do the same?
To that echo of what Obasan Avako had once said, I had no answer at all.